Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this International Women's Day with what is being described as the Republican War on Women, being waged on Capitol Hill and in state houses across the country. Joining us is the Senior Vice President of Greenberg Quinlan Rosner, Dr. Anna Greenberg, the lead author of a survey released today on behalf of Emily's List and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund to explore the impact of the birth control debate on voters in eight battleground Senate states. Then we'll discuss the influence of Ayn Rand on today's politics with Gary Weiss, the author of a new book, Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. We will discuss what is behind the revival of this obscure cult-like ideologue whose posthumous backers, the Koch brothers and others, are distributing her books for free to schools and colleges across the country to gain adherence to an anti-government, pro-business philosophy that espouses altruism is evil, selfishness is a virtue, and greed is good. Then finally, we'll examine the new study released today by the Southern Poverty Law Center that finds a record level of extremist hate groups and militias emerging in 2011. Brian Levin, the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State University San Bernardino, joins us to discuss the report's findings and how much the growth of right-wing extremism is fueled by pervasive racist calumnies against America's first black president, changing demographics, and globalism. And joining us now is Dr. Anna Greenberg, the Senior Vice President of Greenberg Quinlan Rosner and an expert on survey research methodology. In 2006, she played a key role in helping to elect Democratic women to Congress, including Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar and Arizona's Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. Previously, she taught at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government and was a visiting scholar with the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press and a research fellow at American University's Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies. She's the lead author on a survey released today on behalf of Emily's List and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund to explore the impact of the birth control debate on voters in eight battleground Senate states. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Anna Greenberg.
Thank you.
And tell me it seems that there's so many fronts that are operating now in terms of legislative activism at both the House and state houses. Today in the House, for example, the Child Interstate Abortion Notification Act, sponsored by Marco Rubio of the Senate and Ileana Ross-Layton of the House, that was debated. It would make it illegal for anyone but a parent to accompany a young woman across state lines to seek an abortion, even if her parents are absent or abusive. And there are all kinds of bills. State legislatures introduced more than 1,100 anti-abortion provisions and have enacted 135 of them by last year's end. Seven states have either fully defunded or made moves towards defunding Planned Parenthood. So it goes on. I thought much of this, and I'm sure a lot of women in this country feel that these were battles that were won sometimes back in the 20s and 30s. What explains this resurgence?
It's largely a reflection of Republican-based politics. In 2010, when the Republicans took over the House of Representatives and took over a number of state houses and legislatures around the country, the first order of business for many of them was to introduce anti-abortion legislation. I mean, recall that the very first piece of legislation that the House Republicans introduced and passed had to do with abortion, and it's all about base politics. There has been a growing polarization in the country, and also ideological extremism with both parties. It's not just the Republican Party, both the Democratic and Republican parties at the level of elected officials, especially Congress, are sort of increasingly distant ideologically from average voters. And on the Republican side, they have a very important Christian, conservative base, and these kinds of social issues are top of their agenda, and that's exactly what you've seen happen all over the country.
So this is genuinely driven by religious fervor and conviction. It's not a case of cynicism where we talk about everything about the economy and the important things about which we have done nothing or, in fact, made the conditions worse.
Well, there's certainly no evidence that it's helped the Republicans. In fact, since the Republicans took over the House, their brand, if you will, their favorability has declined pretty rapidly over the last year and a half. And in part, I think it's because of a very single-minded focus on social issues, and the degree to which they've focused on economic issues is largely around budget deficit and cuts and trying to dismantle Medicare and Social Security as a way to deal with the budget deficit. And there's a way in which your average voter wonders, why are we, you know, either talking about abortion or birth control or, you know, privatizing Medicare when we have now 8.3% unemployment? There's been no job bill introduced or passed, for example, by the House of Representatives. So I think your average voter is a little mystified, and you can see it in the ratings that the Republicans currently have. You know, there was a point when going into the 2010 election where the Republicans had higher favorability ratings than the Democrats, and that is now reversed. So I'm not suggesting that Democrats have great ratings, but they're certainly better than the Republicans.
So this somewhat inexplicable shift from a 2008 record turnout, a sweep by the Democrats getting the whole trifecta, the White House, the House and the Senate, 2 years later there's a blowout in the opposite direction. Do you think that the pendulum was going to swing back the other way in 2012?
I don't know the answer to that question, because so much really depends on the economy and whether or not the momentum that appears to be gathering around the recovery continues. And I'm not an economist, but economists are divided about whether or not the recovery continues. And I think that has a bigger impact, frankly, than anything else on what happens in 2012. But the social issue debates, and I say the word debate in quotation marks because your average voter doesn't think there's any debate about birth control. There's almost near consensus on both the importance of access to birth control and the importance of employers and insurers covering birth control, but at the elite level, which again is largely about base politics, it has not helped the Republicans, both because it seems to be a distraction from the really important issues, but also because it seems so far out of the mainstream. In fact, Romney was interesting when he was asked about the Blunt Amendment initially, which is a piece of legislation that would say that any institution, any employer could decide that not to cover any medical procedure if it violated their morals or religious, and it's not restricted to birth control or abortion, but obviously it would cover that. And initially, when they asked him about it, not realizing what he was being asked, he said, well, why would I want to get in the middle of a debate about birth control with a man and a woman? That's their decision. And then, you know, a few hours later, he realized, oops, that's not base politics. And he said, oh, I didn't realize you were talking about the Blunt Amendment. Of course I'm for the Blunt Amendment. So I think even, you know, Romney, who's trying very hard to play to the right, in an unguarded moment, acknowledge the consensus we have about birth control and it being, you know, a private decision between people who are who need it for whatever reason, and certainly not something that government should be involved in.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Anna Greenberg, who is a expert on survey research methodology. She's with the senior vice president with Quinlan, with Greenberg Quinlan Rosner, and she is the lead author of a study released today on behalf of Emily's List and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund to explore the impact of the birth control debate on voters in 8 battleground Senate states. Before we get to your study, Anna Greenberg, today a group of women senators held a press conference on Capitol Hill to warn John Boehner in the House not to take up the Blunt Amendment. There's certainly no guarantee that that won't happen. The Blunt Amendment, of course, was so poorly written that any business could opt out on the basis of a conscience. I mean, Scientologist businesses could, of course, deny coverage for anything to do with psychiatry, etc. It was such a poorly drawn piece of legislation. I'm surprised that the House will pick it up, but I suspect they might.
Well, that what the women senators did, which actually I think was smart, was largely a political ploy, which is to say, put Speaker Boehner on the spot and force him to either say, no, I'm not going to bring this up for a vote, in which case you annoy the base, or put him in a position of saying, yes, I'm going to bring it to a vote, in which case it would pass. There's over 220 Republican co-sponsors of the legislation, in which case you have another week or two of coverage around what, in the poll that was released today, 60% of Americans, oppose. And it further sort of gives the impression that the Republican Party is not in the mainstream. I think that the Republican Party is so trapped by its base, particularly in the middle of a Republican primary process where Mitt Romney, who is not the conservative candidate, is trying to be the conservative candidate against some very conservative candidates, that it's very hard for Republicans to break out of this, and I am sure there are a number of them who would be more than happy to not have another 2 weeks of a conversation about birth control, because that's another 2 weeks where, A, they're talking about issues where most Americans disagree with them and see them as outside of the mainstream, and, B, another couple weeks of not talking about the economy and attacking Obama's sort of stewardship of the economy. So really, that press conference by these senators was mostly to force John Boehner's hand.
Well, the New Hampshire Republican-controlled House, of course, voted yesterday to exempt religious institutions from having to include contraceptive coverage in health insurance plans, very reminiscent of the Blunt Amendment. However,
well, and by the way, let me just say about New Hampshire. I mean, they have a big governor's race there. This is a very libertarian state. It is not. It is a conservative state, primarily on fiscal issues. It is not a religiously conservative state. It is a majority pro-choice state. They had, a Republican takeover of the legislature in 2010. I think this is a huge mistake for Republicans in New Hampshire. I think it actually sets up the Democratic candidate for governor in a way that, frankly, there's a primary, so you don't know who it's going to be, but this candidate was not set up before. So even at the state level, doing these sort of things, especially in a state like New Hampshire, which is a pretty socially liberal state, is, in my view, a huge error. I would add Scott Brown, who's the incumbent Republican in Massachusetts, who is a co-sponsor of the Blunt Amendment, again, I think another significant miscalculation on the part of Republicans in, basically blue states.
Well, just before this vote in New Hampshire, the Kaiser Family Foundation survey indicated that 63% of Americans favored Obama's policy requiring free birth control coverage for female employees. And the survey of 1,500 adults showed public opinion breaking more strongly towards party affiliation than gender on contraceptives, with 83% for Democrats, 62% for independents, and 42% for Republicans favoring the policy. So tell us about your findings released today, Anna Greenberg.
Well, we have had a very similar result in that a majority of people favored, in our poll, it was 55%, favored insurers and employers, covering contraception, and that's without the religious exemption that emerged out of the quote-unquote compromise. What was interesting is that when we tested the compromise, which would allow an employer not to pay for the coverage, but require the insurer to pay for it. So in essence, if you were a religious institution, you wouldn't directly be paying for, say, birth control coverage. People were less likely to support the compromise. And frankly, that was because people who were pro-choice didn't like the compromise. So I think in the president's attempt to sort of tack to the center on this, though center, again, when you're in an area where there's consensus, the center is pretty progressive. It turns out that compromise actually was less popular because it alienated pro-choice and progressive voters. The other thing I would say about the Kaiser results that you just mentioned, it's absolutely the case that partisanship trumps gender on a lot of issues. People assume this is a quote-unquote women's issue, but in fact, there are as many men who oppose this policy as there are women, and really, where someone sits ideologically has a bigger impact on where they are on this issue. What's also interesting about those numbers is that you have a majority of independent voters who support the policy, and a significant number of Republicans. I mean, in a country that is so polarized around party, Republicans are pretty divided on this. And again, it just goes to my point about this being an area of consensus for people, and Republicans sort of picking a fight because of their base politics that does not position them well with average voters.
And in the key seven states, right, that you looked, eight battleground states, for the Senate. That was your mandate, right?
Yes, we did a poll across Senate states, so, Massachusetts, Missouri, a range of other of Senate races. Obviously, the Senate races are pretty important this cycle, especially as Maine's Governor, Senator Olympia Snowe decided not to run again. It actually makes the Senate a little more competitive for Democrats, and so that's why we were looking at those races.
Well, we saw what happened in Virginia. It seems to me that there is politics to some extent is Pavlovian. At a certain point, when the electorate feels sufficient pain, they get up off the couches and go out. And in this case, in Virginia, they stormed the state house. Thousands of people showed up.
Well, it's true. I mean, what's really been interesting about all of this is after the feeling of Republican dominance, especially after the 2010 elections, there's been a pretty significant backlash. And it's not just Virginia, where you had this kind of invasive ultrasound bill around abortion, but it's Rush Limbaugh. So you have, people backing off on the Republican side, which is somewhat unprecedented.
Well, it's true.
I don't know that it has the potential to do major mobilization in the election, but it's certainly been interesting to watch, 50 advertisers leave the Limbaugh show, Governor McDonald, who's on the short list, probably to be a vice presidential candidate on the Republican ticket, have to, basically back down, though the legislation they ultimately passed is still pretty terrible from a pro-choice perspective. And so it's interesting to watch Republicans sort of get burned as they kind of mindlessly pursue this kind of base politics strategy.
Well, but it doesn't seem to in any way to have deterred the Kansas legislature. Just today, and I think by Monday, they'll take the vote. The House, the Senate seems poised, and the governor's already... Actually, there's a chance the Senate may not pass it, but the governor, former Senator Sam Brownback, is all too willing to pass a law now that will make women have to pay for abortions, and even victims of rape. And they've also apparently in this bill, they've included some text that says that medical students can't be taught to perform abortions, which is a whole new level of intrusion into finding ways to either frustrate, humiliate, embarrass, shame women into preventing them from doing something that they clearly do with great reluctance in the first place.
Well, of course it doesn't dissuade the true believers. I mean, and certainly not in a state like Kansas, which is a very conservative state with a very conservative governor and legislature. And, in Kansas, there will be very little consequence to passing that sort of legislation because it's a very conservative place. But I do think that Republicans have gone too far. I think that there are many women who would not consider themselves feminists who believe they have the right to determine their own trajectory in life, and that includes controlling when they have a baby or if they have a baby, and that everybody's circumstance is different and that you can't legislate around these issues. And I just, I've worked for the pro-choice movement for a long time, and it's been hard to get people, especially people who were born after Roe versus Wade, was decided, which is now about 40 years on, to believe that a woman's right to choose or her reproductive health was, under assault. And I think that what the Republicans have been doing over the last year and a half, especially now, has done more for the pro-choice movement and more to, if you look at the number of people who are now joining, contributing to pro-choice organizations, has done more to mobilize the other side than they, I think, possibly could have imagined. And so I think it backfires, honestly.
Well, it's so strange that Rush Limbaugh should become the spokesperson against contraception. I think he's been married 3 or 4 times and still doesn't have any children. So I don't want to speculate why he's avoided parenthood.
Well, the hypocrisy of many people on the right never surprises me anymore. So.
Okay. Well, on this International Women's Day, I thank you for joining us here today, Dr. Anna Greenberg.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Anna Greenberg, who's a senior vice president at Greenberg Quinlan Rosner and an expert on survey research methodology. In 2006, she played a key role in helping to elect Democratic women to Congress, including Minnesota's Senator Amy Klobuchar and Arizona's Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. Previously, she taught at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government and was a visiting scholar with the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, and is a research fellow at American University's Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies. She is the lead author on a survey released today on behalf of Emily's List and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund to explore the impact of the birth control debate on voters in 8 battleground Senate states. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Ayn Rand's Nation, the hidden struggle for America's soul.
Hey, beautiful bird, I said, digging her somber mood. The fascists are some heavy dudes. They don't really give a damn about life. They just don't want a woman to control her body or have the right to choose. But baby, that ain't nothing. They just want a male finger on the button. Because if you say war, they will send them to die by the score. Aborting mission should be your volition. But if Suda and Thomas have their way, you'll be standing.
Bang, bang, yeah. That's how we start the show. Eagle soar and oil flow. You didn't decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Crime depends from who you stole. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, hitting low. Motion is perpetual. We call drill to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. No, where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say ride slow. Dudes, don't let them play us.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gary Weiss, a journalist and author of two books probing the underside of finance, Wall Street versus America and Born to Steal. He was an award-winning investigative reporter for Business Week, and his articles have appeared in Condé Nast Portfolio, Parade Magazine, Salon, and the New York Times, among other publications. His newest book just out is Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Weiss.
Hi there, Ian. Pleasure to be here.
And this is 30 years after the death of Ayn Rand, and she's never been more popular than ever, I guess. And she certainly died, I think, in somewhat obscurity, paradoxically, living on Social Security and Medicare, the very government program she has contempt for. But what's the current status of her books? Because they really become bestsellers after her death.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, they were bestsellers during her lifetime as well. But in recent years, they've really exploded in popularity. In 2009, 600,000 copies were sold of Atlas Shrugged. That's an enormous, enormous amount. Really puts her right at the top of the bestseller list.
But none of this is happening by accident. This is all organized. This is the Ayn Rand Institute apparently giving these books away to English classes throughout all American schools and to colleges as well. And that in itself is odd, given how her books were universally panned as really shoddy and somewhat embarrassing literature. But the Ayn Rand Institute really do have an agenda, and it seems that they're being very successful.
Yes, they're very successful. They actually distribute, I believe, about 250,000 books per year, something like that, in addition to the 600,000 books that are sold of Atlas Shrugged. This is in addition to it. They give away books to English classes throughout the country in return. You know, they'll give you a copy of Atlas Shrugged if you will teach it. And teachers, as you know, schools are very hard pressed for money. And you know, look, somebody's going to give them free books; they'll take it. It's really quite shameless.
So, your book that's just out, Gary Weiss, Ayn Rand Nation: The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. It's important because she's become so important, and it's not an accident, as you point out in your book, that she has become well known. There are very wealthy industrialists like the Koch brothers and others who are trying to propagate her propaganda, and they appear to be very successful, both with the Tea Party, which is somewhat odd because Ayn Rand was such an ardent atheist, but it also seems to be very successful in the Ron Paul arena, even though he's hardly going to win the presidential nomination. He's still got a pretty substantial support base, and one of the things that I find extraordinary is how libertarianism is gaining in appeal with young Americans, and perhaps this is an example of the failure of the Democrats to have any kind of ideology that's attractive to the young. But the long and short of it is that, you know, it's happening. Now, your book basically tells us in part why it's happening. It's because people, wealthy cult-like followers of Ayn Rand, are pushing her agenda.
Absolutely. Very well financed. The Ayn Rand Institute is very well financed, and they've done a really excellent job of propagating her views, not just to the general public so much as the Tea Party movement. You've had the sort of the wholesaling of Ayn Rand to the Tea Party movement, and the Tea Party movement that then sort of retailed, so to speak, her views. You'll notice that the Tea Party movement does not generally get involved in social issues. Now, that's a reflection of Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand did not believe in pushing social issues. She did not believe in pushing abortion, for instance, you know, the cause of, trying to curtail abortion. She believed strictly in laissez-faire capitalism. That was her only Pirelli cause. And she was, as you point out, she was an atheist, and that's what makes this whole thing very unusual. In the book, I interview people, you know, like atheists in the Tea Party movement. There are such things. It's a really sort of a weird phenomena that you have here, is you have an atheistic movement having strong influence on the Republican right, but that's exactly what you're seeing.
Well, but her anti-government fundamentalism was so profound that she opposed the U.S. entry into World War II after the U.S. was attacked at Pearl Harbor.
That's correct. She was opposed to the U.S. entry into World War II. She was also opposed to the Vietnam War, too. You know, there's a certain amount of similarity on foreign policy between her and Ron Paul. The exception, and this is the reason why the Ayn Rand people don't like Ron Paul, is that she was very pro-Israel, and Ron Paul is not quite pro-Israel, to say the least. So you have that, but her sole issue, really, you know, foreign policy was always secondary. It was always focused, hyper-focused on capitalism, and I think that I think I charted that pretty carefully in the book, that she was a major influence ideologically for the financial crisis of 2008. I mean, you had the ideology of greed, and that was Ayn Rand.
Again, I'm speaking with Gary Weiss, a journalist and author of two books probing the underside of finance, Wall Street versus America, and Born to Steal. He's an award-winning investing reporter for Business Week, and his latest book just out is Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. Now, clearly, the real influence in terms of propagating her philosophy and enacting it in changing our lives. And nobody dominated American finance and economics more than Alan Greenspan. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't just a disciple of hers. He was the executor of her will. He was one of the most loyal of this weird cult-like people that hung around her. And of course, you know, she had that bizarre affair with Nathaniel Brandon, stole him away from his wife, almost commanded him to have an affair, I assume. I don't know, what kind of an acolyte was Greenspan in terms of that relationship?
Oh, you couldn't have gotten a closer relationship, platonic, I must add, but between Rand and Greenspan. I mean, Greenspan, to a certain extent, was almost her chief financial officer or her, you know, minister of finance. He wrote articles for Randian newsletters. You know, if you read his memoirs, you'd think it was just a youthful infatuation, but he was an important theoretician. I think people don't understand that Greenspan was not just a follower of Ayn Rand, he was a theoretician of her philosophy. He propagated her philosophy. He helped devise her philosophy in terms of regulation. He wrote a very important essay for her compendium of essays on capitalism, in which he argued strenuously against the very concept of regulation, even down to building codes. A very extremist essay, and he wrote that, and he says in his memoirs that he was a youthful acolyte. He was propagating her philosophy when he was in his 40s and 50s. I know that's pretty youthful nowadays, but I don't call that a youthful acolyte.
Well, there's no question that what he did when he was at the Fed, encouraging deregulation and getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act.
Yeah.
And in fact, in your book, you quote one of Greenspan's essays, The Assault on Integrity.
Yeah.
Where he talks about his ideas or gives you an idea of how completely naive he was about the very Wall Street that he was allegedly overseeing. He says it is precisely the greed of the businessman, or more appropriately, his profit-seeking, which is the unexcelled protector of the consumer. It is in the self-interest of every businessman to have a reputation for honest dealings and a quality product. I mean, that's so idealistic and naive. It's breathtaking. It's almost Norman Rockwell.
Oh, he used the very same logic in order to argue against building codes. Now, he knew perfectly well. I mean, everyone who grew up in New York City was aware of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, where building codes were basically non-existent at the time, and people died. You don't have regulation of buildings, people die. When you don't have regulation of banking, people lose money. The public suffers. He knew this, but he was ideologically indoctrinated by Rand from an early age.
So, Gary Weiss, you know, I'm talking to you from right across the street from Universal Studios here in North Hollywood, and I knew a lot of the Hollywood 10, the people who were blacklisted, most of whom are no longer with us, but Ayn Rand had quite a role in ginning up the blacklist, didn't she? And in part, it would seem that what motivated her, apart from her ideology, was the fact that she was a kind of a bitter, failed screenwriter.
Yeah, she was a screenwriter of... She was a screenwriter. I wouldn't quite call her a failed screenwriter. She was a mediocre screenwriter, and she did not really make much of a career of it. But she was a screenwriter and a playwright. And she was, as you point out, she was a friendly witness before the House Un-American Activities Committee when they were having their Hollywood hearings, when they were going after, very frequently innocent people in Hollywood. She was a supporter of McCarthy, although she denied it. And she had a very twisted view of the film industry. She believed that, it's very interesting. She described certain films, and if you go and actually look at these films, they were different from the way she described them. It was in keeping with her. She just had just sort of a very strange attitude toward reality. Her reality was different from the reality of other people. And you see this basically throughout her teachings and throughout basically everything that she wrote.
Well, but there are people on the right today that are followers of hers who try to use the same tactics. In other words, she, at the time of the House of Un-American Activities, she was bitter about the talent. The talent was on the left. Mm. And that still seems to be the case, you know, but for Chuck Norris on the right, most, you know, the Brad Pitts and company are all tend to be on the liberal side. And there's still this constant, effort on the part of conservatives to basically say that they need equal time in Hollywood. And every time they are given an opportunity, the movies fall flat. And there's no better example of that than the Atlas Shrugged movie.
Right. That was a disaster. If you haven't seen it, I don't recommend it. It was just very poorly conceived, not very well done. You know, interestingly, I interviewed Oliver Stone. For the book, and he had a very interesting take on The Fountainhead, you know, on her first novel, which is about an architect, and about how about integrity and individuality, which of course, as in all things, she brought to an extreme. But his concept, his take on Fountainhead, which I have in the book toward the end, is quite interesting. I mean, it raises the point that in fact, certain aspects of her philosophy can, in fact, in the hands of a person of integrity, they can be used for positive ends. I'm referring to her views on people's self-esteem. I mean, if modified, if modulated, and if brought into contact with reality, certain aspects of Rand's teachings, I think, might have practical value to society. And that's the subject that I explored with Oliver Stone in the chapter I have on his thinking on that.
But that was the movie that was supposed to happen with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, right?
Right. Yeah, he was going to do a adaptation of The Fountainhead, which originally was made into a not very good movie with Gary Cooper,
right,
and Patricia Neal in 1949. And he was going to remake it, and interestingly, and I go into some detail on this, he was going to remake it so that rather than the Howard Rourke character being a very selfish person who only thought of himself, he was going to turn Howard Rourke into an altruist. He was going to sort of hijack. It's really kind of amusing because the Ayn Rand people would have gone ballistic if this ever happened. Oliver Stone was going to turn the Howard Rourke character into an altruistic person who served society. That's contrary to everything Ayn Rand believed, and I think it's actually kind of amusing, but it's also touching in a way because it shows that to me, I value that chapter because it sort of brought everything back to reality. You know, here's reality, in a sense. Here's how people actually think. I mean, this is the morality that most people have. You know, when you spend as many months as I did in Ayn Rand's world, you become sort of out of touch, you know, with the way people really think and what morality really is. Rand turned morality on its head. She turned bad into good, good into bad.
Yeah, railing against altruism as an evil and trying to propagate the notion that selfishness and greed are good, because that reminds me a little of talking about Oliver Stone. That's right out of the mouth of Gordon Gekko.
Absolutely.
So, Gary Weiss, But some of these wealthy internet entrepreneurs up in the Silicon Valley here in California are huge followers of hers as well, as is, the vice president of Arlene Mann, managing director and associate general counsel of, on the board of Goldman Sachs and Company.
Yes.
So they've got their people, and of course the Koch brothers are financing a lot of the Ayn Rand distributions and Cato. Actually, they're embroiled now in a battle of taking over the Cato Institute, which is an interesting intra-libertarian squabble going on. I don't know whether you're following that one, but...
Oh, I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah. So what is it, the attraction of these internet types here in California towards her? Is it the fact that they've just gotten so incredibly rich so quickly that they are trying to sort of find a philosophy to retroactively justify their realities? I'm not quite sure.
Well, I think the reason why Rand is so popular among people who've become very wealthy very suddenly is that Rand provides you with a very quick, easy justification for not being, first of all, not being guilty, you know, about the fact that you're rich and other people aren't. It provides a moral and philosophical justification for not giving away a lot of your money. Rand's people were outraged by the giving pledge that recently received some publicity among certain, you know, billionaires like Warren Buffett and so forth.
Bill Gates, right? He's given away a lot of his money. Yeah, he actually gave it to Bill.
They were outraged, and they feel, look, you earned it, you keep it, you are under no obligation to give it away. And it's the philosophy of selfishness that she pushed. Look, she said, in effect, you don't have to feel guilty about wanting to have something. It's yours. You can have it. Selfishness is good. In fact, altruism is evil. That was her philosophy. So this does appeal to people who've made a lot of money.
Well, there seems to be, though,
they don't want to keep it.
There's also, I think, even though Santorum is more of a religious scold and hardly fits in the definition of a Tea Party Ayn Rand acolyte or a libertarian Ayn Rand acolyte, had his speech the other night after the Super Tuesday, he made this strange speech about railing against Obamacare, which is pretty much the central theme of the Republican campaign against President Obama. Clearly, there must be a lot of people out there who feel this way, and that it's so hard to understand how, working Americans who are having a hard time in this recession wouldn't want to have affordable health care. But I don't know how it ties into Ayn Rand, but it feels sort of Randian in a way because it's so sort of didactic and so insane in a way. And I'm wondering, are there deeper roots in the conservatism here that she's tapping into? Because, ironically, what Santorum said was that he hates Obamacare because it means big government is invading your body, which is exactly what the pro-choice feminists say about the anti-abortion people who want government to outlaw abortion.
Oh, precisely. And as a matter of fact, Rand was consistent. She was a proponent of abortion. She was against the anti-abortion movement, so she was consistent. But I heard that speech, and it really struck me as a really Randian speech. Every time you hear politicians talk about the government invading the person, whether they're using that type of phraseology consistently or hypocritically, as in the case of Santorum, They're echoing Rand. You know, it gets back to the point that I raised earlier about how Rand was the Marx, the Karl Marx of the right. She laid down principles which are propagated by the right, and specifically by the radical right. And as you get closer to the center, her views fade. But as you go out to the edges, as you go out to the Santorums, as you go out to Ron Paul, for instance, that's where you get closer to Rand's theory being put into practice and being basically propagated.
Well, at the end of your book, Gary Weiss, Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul, it's a very sobering way to get a portrait of an America, a perfect Ayn Rand America. It should be compulsory reading just as much as the Ayn Rand Institute are pushing her book around the country to schools and colleges, giving the way to free And there's, you know, a direct relationship between her the revival of her popularity and the efforts on the part of the Koch brothers and others to push her so-called philosophy or propaganda. But your dystopian epilogue, the way you show what a devastating landscape America would be without public services, no public transportation, no hospitals, no safety net, no food, no drug laws, nothing but the ultra wealthy. And then, wait a minute, isn't that what we have? Mm. Aren't we heading that way from a democracy into an oligarchy?
Well, I think we're heading slowly in that direction. We haven't reached the point yet where... for instance, there's no public education. I mean, Rand's people are against the very concept of public education. They want only private education. They're against child labor laws. We're talking about turning back the clock to a point that you've really never had in this country. You know, Rand always used to say that there has never been a point in American history where you had true laissez-faire capitalism, which means that no matter how far back you turn back the clock to 1812, 1810, 1790, not good enough for the Rand people. They don't want even that much government. They don't want any government except the police, the courts, the military. That's it. And everybody else has to really fend for themselves.
Well, just in closing, Gary Wise, a lot of this revolution that's just taken place, and particularly in 2010, with the Tea Party and the governors that were brought in who have really enacted a fairly radical agenda, a lot of them are Randian acolytes. I understand the Ohio governor, Kasich, the Wisconsin governor, Scott Walker, who, of course, is being facing a recall, the poster boy for the Republicans' new economic policy, Congressman Ryan. He apparently, it's compulsory in his office to read her work. So give us a sense of how Ayn Rand is alive and well on Capitol Hill.
Well, Ayn Rand is alive and well every time you see an effort to turn back regulation, turn back the size of government. Every time you see an effort to... shut down the government over the debt limit. That's a reflection of Rand, you know, her strike, the strike that you see in Atlas Shrugged. Pretty much to the extent that you see ideology taking over Capitol Hill, the radical right ideology taking over Capitol Hill, that has its roots. It's not always directly dictated, shall we say, by the Ayn Rand Institute, but I'd say that it has its roots in Ayn Rand's philosophy. In order to understand what is happening in this country, you really have to understand Ayn Rand. And that's why I wrote this book. I think people don't. I knew I didn't understand when I started work on this. People have to understand Ayn Rand and understand the breadth of her philosophy. That's what I tried to do in the book.
Well, but it's the people who are acolytes cover such a wide... We've talked about the Koch brothers, and then you've got the Tea Party activist Mark Meckler that you profiled, this fellow Yaron Brook of the Ayn Rand Institute, and then you've got the anti-Islamist Pamela Geller. So how come it covers such a sort of broad swath of right-wing ideology?
With a very broad swath, because Rand was just so popular. You know, we're talking about a person, one opinion poll that was carried out by the Zogby Institute found that something like 31% of the American people had read Atlas Shrugged. That's an enormous number of people had read it.
Well, that's because they've been giving it away to high school, surely.
Absolutely. That's part of it. Also, just people buy the book. It's been a very popular book. Why it's popular, I try to explore that. Why is it popular? I think it's got a lot to do with the manner in which it's written. It's the book does move along. I mean, I think it's a better read than people give it credit for. It's not literature. It's pulp. But it does appeal to people at a gut level. I think you have to admit that book does appeal to people. And it influences people's thinking in a very profound way, and that's what we're seeing happen here. And there's no pushback. You see, that concerns me is that there's really no pushback. There's no other side to it. There's no effort, certainly by the Democrats, to propound an ideology that would counter Rand, or that would just say, look, you know, government is capable of doing good. perhaps just that simply. You don't really see that from the other side.
Well, Gary Weiss, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Gary Weiss, a journalist and author of two books probing the underside of finance, Wall Street versus America, and Born to Steal. He was an award-winning investing reporter for Business Week, and his articles have appeared in Condé Nast Portfolio, Parade Magazine, Salon, and the New York Times, among other publications. His newest book just out is Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the just-released report on the growth of militias in this country opposed to President Obama.
So all of the business and unlimited hell where they buy and they sell all their trash to each other till they're sick of it all and they're bankrupt on selling. And all of the angels, they sell off your soul for a set of new wings and anything gold they remember.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as the Associate Director of Legal Affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Brian, are you on a speakerphone by any chance?
No, I am not.
Oh, okay.
Let me try something a little better. Hold on.
Okay.
How's that?
Oh, much, much better. Much better. Thank you.
Sure.
So I know you and I've spoken to Mark Potok before as well with the Southern Poverty Law Center. You've been following the rise of these hate groups for many, many years. But before we get into the militias and the lists here, because you've got this lists of the hate groups that have emerged in 2011, I can go through them quickly. The Ku Klux Klan, 152, neo-Nazi, 170, white nationalists, 146, racist skinheads, 133, Christian identity, 55, neo-Confederate, 32, black separatists, 140, and general hate groups, 190. I tell you, Brian, the one hate group that I really find most disturbing are people like the white U.S. federal judge in Montana who sent that email joke to his friends.
That terrible email, yes.
I mean, isn't there's sort of two levels of hate and racism in this country. There's the overt kind of redneck Klan type, and then there's the sort of silent, closeted white professional sort of hatred.
I think you're exactly right, and it's nothing new. We saw that with the White Citizens Council during the 50s and 60s. They were the button-down and tie Ku Klux Klan. And similarly today, you know, there was a decline in the number of Ku Klux Klan groups down from about 221 to about 152. But there's also a number of neo-Confederate groups, and they're not as in-your-face, but they're just a diluted version of that kind of bigotry. So we see that quite a bit, and I think you made a really important point, and I'm so glad you made it, and that is there's a lot of bigotry and conspiracy theories and, frankly, just perspectives that are not helpful to truth-seeking and a pluralistic democracy that have seeped over from the extreme into the mainstream. The whole birther movement, for instance. The fact that on Lou Dobbs, when he was on CNN, folks could get on there and make completely defamatory statements about Mexicans bringing leprosy into the country when the statistics they gave were completely false. So we've seen, as you've said, this merging of bigoted and conspiratorial and hateful rhetoric with no foundation, which used to be segregated to the extreme, now in the mainstream, getting out, you know, the whole concentration camps being hidden from the American citizens, being put on the Glenn Beck show kind of thing. And that, I think, is nefarious.
So the report that came out from the Southern Poverty Law Center of the 2011 hate groups, naming 1,018, that's up from 602 in the year 2000. How much is this, and of course California has the dubious distinction of being the nation's leader with 84 hate groups, how much is this increase attributed to this absolute pathological hatred that so many Americans on the right have for President Obama, whether it's the overt racist signs that Tea Party, gunslinging Tea Partiers have held up at rallies, or the kind of country club vicious hatred displayed by the Montana federal judge?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, we have to recognize that there are people of goodwill, and there are people who have legitimate public policy disagreements with the president and do not dislike him and just disagree with him. There are, however, folks who do dislike him because he's African-American and they call him a socialist and he wasn't born here and all that kind of stuff. And I think you've hit on something, and that is I think there's a split where there are people of goodwill who really want to debate public policy and conservative people of goodwill. And then there are the, you know, even like Donald Trump entertained this whole birther thing, or Joe Arpaio out in Arizona. And what I think is interesting, in the first part of the decade, we saw a lot of the hate movement being fueled by anti-immigrant and Islamophobic sentiment. And then with the advent of the election of President Obama, you know, things kind of almost went off the rails. I mean, he's regarded virtually as the Antichrist by some of these folks. In fact, interestingly enough, some of this is coming from both sides of the political spectrum. There were people on the left who said that Bush, you know, was behind 9/11, and public policy polling, I believe, came out with some research showing that about 18 or 19% thought that Bush was the Antichrist, was or could be the Antichrist, and an almost equal number said similar stuff about President Obama. So I think we've really had a denigration in our discourse in this country, and a lot of it is fueled by, I think, social media, which allows people to kind of splinter and only associate with like-minded fellow travelers, if they so choose, who only fuel their conspiracy theories and anger. And additionally, just the fact that we're not looking at things, I think, in the way that we did maybe decades ago of working together to trying to come to some common ground. And the kind of terrible attacks against President Obama that are without foundation, just hateful, I think you make an excellent point. And that, unfortunately, has become part of the currency of the mainstream. And, for instance, you know, Pat Buchanan has talked about, you know, not only that he disagrees with public policy positions, but this whole kind of diminution of European culture by the diversity of our country and where it's headed. And that, I think, is kind of dangerous.
Well, Pat Buchanan is not the only one who uses that buzzword, European socialism, Saul Alinsky, radical. That's Gingrich's mantra.
Look, if you're saying, are there people who are in mainstream politics who are coming out with nefarious statements that heretofore were segregated onto the extreme fringes, I'd agree with you. But by the same token, we see stuff on the left, too. Jeremiah Wright, I think, was an example of that as well, where I think people get so upset about what they see as the country going in the wrong direction that they believe that this kind of nefarious anger is properly presented in civil discourse, and of course it's actually quite damaging.
Well, I certainly agree with you. Then there's no argument that there's equal or rampant ignorance on both the left and the right in this country, and a lack of critical thinking all around. And in many ways, the 9/11 conspiracies do meet at the same place. People who think they're on the left support it, and the guy that's propagated a lot of that is a right-wing. Virulent anti-government right-winger, Waco guy, Jones, I think his name is. I can't think of his name right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, and you know, again, yeah. But I think you're making excellent points, and you know, our center's nonpartisan. But let me say this: the sovereign citizens movement does not have quite an analog on the left. I mean, to the extent that there are anarchists, I guess perhaps, but the sovereign citizen movement really is quite dangerous because they say that the founding fathers' principles of citizenship have been usurped by the current government, and President Obama represents, you know, this evil usurpation of it. And what it has done, it is really created a division that has now seeped over into the mainstream, where people are not going to disagree with President Obama about, you know, bailouts or medical insurance. What they're doing is trying to delegitimize him as a person. So what do? They say he's not a citizen. They accuse him of lying about his faith. I mean, these kinds of things that do nothing to advance civil discourse. And similarly, you know, people who used to have bumper stickers that had Bush with a swastika in it. What does that do to advance resolution of issues and bring us forward? But right now we have seen explosive growth on the extreme right. I am not talking about conservative people of goodwill who may disagree with folks about gay marriage or abortion or gun control, but still are part of the system and are not necessarily bigoted. Those folks, God bless them. But what we do see is a growing movement, particularly sovereign citizens who number anywhere between 100,000 and 300,000, who think that the government is illegitimate. And some of these folks are also white supremacists as well, although not all of them. And some of them are violent, although the overwhelming majority of them are not.
Well, Brian Levin, I thank you for joining us here today and for filling us in on this new report by the Southern Poverty Law Center of the growth of 1,018 hate groups nationally. And it's one of the one thing in this country that we need less of. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. One other note, there are also 1,200 anti-government groups in addition to the 1,000 hate groups that you just mentioned.
Again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State University in San Bernardino. He's also been the associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. I'll be back again tomorrow on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Love.